A taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
A very good evening and welcome to A Taste of Ireland. I'm Ed Finn and my special guest this evening is former news presenter, journalist, UNICEF ambassador and household name, Anne Doyle. You're very welcome to the show.
Ed, I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
Anne, how are you? How are you keeping?
I'm keeping as well as any of us are in these troubled times. I'm very well, thank you.
Are you enjoying a golden retirement?
Well, I'm a kind of an honest person, believe it or not, Ed. And another way of looking at it would be I was never all that crazy about work. So the idea of a world in which I didn't have to go to work every day was always very agreeable to me. And I have been very lucky to have had a pretty good time for what has been now, mercifully, quite a long life.
You grew up, of course, in Ferns in County Wexford. And you had a very happy childhood.
I had a great childhood. I grew up in a townland, Coolator, which in those days would have been astonishingly rural. As you know, Wexford, County Wexford, is now home, or at the very least holiday home and often home, to a great many people from Dublin. But it was, I was born at the start of 52, and it was a very, very rural place indeed then. And in some respects, it was an idyllic childhood. Nobody had any money, so that doesn't sound all that attractive. But we were a large and happy family, and we always had enough to eat. We were loved, and we had a pretty good time.
And you went to Loretto Convent Boarding School for 4 years, I think.
So I did 5 years for my sins. I was a scholarship girl all the way. That was before the free education scheme was introduced. That was in 1966. These are dates that will mean absolutely nothing to a young thing like you. So I was lucky enough to have a County Council scholarship. It didn't feel all that lucky when I was going off to boarding school, as you will imagine. But look, it was the way it was at the time, and we knuckled down. There wasn't really any alternative. And I would have to say that my experience there with the Loretto nuns was as pleasant as being away from home at that age is likely to be. They were kind and kindly women.
You always wanted to move to Dublin. Was that the plan?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had quite lost the run of myself in the 60s. Regrettably, I don't seem quite to have recaptured what preceded it. Quite a few of my fellow pupils were from Dublin. And it was that era where the boutiques were creeping in even to Dublin. London, of course, was the centre of the universe, Carnaby Street and all of that. And Belfast was always considered actually much cooler than Dublin. You really aspired because they had that access to and from London that we didn't have. But my pals would shop for me and get me ridiculously, disgracefully short or ludicrously long dresses and have my poor father worried sick about his youngest and my mother covering for me and saying she's not really going out in that. And of course, what you were actually going to change into was hidden in the bag, never mind the disgraceful thing you were going out in. Some things don't change, Ed.
So you were very adventurous, and making clandestine trips up to Belfast at a young age.
I went to Belfast for the first time, lying, of course, with a couple of friends from Dublin in 66. But I was always, you know, it was the time of taste. I have remained a very, very big fan of Van Morrison. It is impossible not to be. The man is a genius. And also over the years, I regret to say, it sounds awful, I had a series of boyfriends from Belfast. So I spent a great deal of my time there. It took me years to work out that you actually could travel up and down to Belfast and have a very good time without actually having a boyfriend there.
Wonderful.
Slow learner.
Belfast, of course, today has changed. I mean, it is an amazing bohemian city today. It can compete with anywhere now, I suppose.
It's wonderful to see, even in these difficult times, it's wonderful to see Belfast having come back to itself. very much bow to its glory days, because God knows there was such a long, dark period in between.
And was it your plan always to get into broadcasting and the media then when you came? You went to college, of course, in Dublin then.
I did. I went to UCD. I was lucky enough to manage to get another 4 years of avoiding work. My subjects were history and English, chosen probably because I was fairly handy at them and didn't think I'd have to work too hard. This is not a very good example I'm giving here. As regarding my plan, with a certain amount of regret and a certain amount of pleasure, Ed, I have to tell you that in my entire life, I have never had a plan.
So it was probably fate, Anne, was it?
Fate, desperation, good fortune. It's better to be lucky than anything else, really. And overall, with some awful bits along the way, but nobody escapes those, I've been extremely lucky. Like many's the little cat, I fell on my feet.
And of course, you've had this fabulous career in RT. How did you come to find your way out to Montrose?
Well, as ever, it didn't take a lot of pre-planning. A friend of mine, a woman I worked with, noticed the ad. Ad was in the evening paper, or maybe it was the press anyway. That's how long ago that was. I was the last newsreader who came in through that public ad process. After that, people more sensibly, really, in my opinion, moved into that area, say from continuity or working as reporters in the newsroom, or at the very least having, you know, a background in that area. I was working in the Department of Foreign Affairs on Stephen's Green. I had no background of any shape or description. I thought it'd be a handy number, Ed. You, a seasoned and splendid broadcaster, you know that it isn't all that handy a number at all. I certainly got quite the shock.
It is quite a stressful job, really, Anne. And I mean, it does involve an awful lot of, you know, of nerves of steel, I think, to a certain extent.
Well, you see, I really hadn't any idea what it was like. I thought that my pal actually said to me, I remember we were sitting, oddly enough, in a pub, and my pal said to me, that'd suit you down to the ground, Anne. You know, a lot of reading, because I always loved reading, as if that had anything to do with it. You know, a lot of reading and kind of, you know, drop in of an evening. I mean, that was the first shock. And, you know, until the day I retired, Ed, one thing, and I'm not a hot-tempered person, I used to have to bite my tongue when people, as they often did, said to me, oh, it must be great, Anne. You go in about 8 o'clock at night and get your hair done, you know, and you think, does it really look that easy? I'll take it as a compliment if I make it look that easy. I suddenly discovered that this was a hard day's work every day and a test of nerve that I really felt for a long time I wasn't up to. I was a permanent wreck, to tell you the truth.
You worked through some kind of really interesting times in Ireland. I mean, when you look back at the Hawke Fitzgerald, the politics, Thatcher, hunger strikes, you know, was it a great time to be a newsreader? I mean, was it quite fascinating?
In the political context, there were indeed a number of periods that were absolutely fascinating. And I've always been interested in politics. I kind of grew up in an Ireland where people's politics were very clearly defined. Mine have never been so clearly defined, you know, because I was just that generation later. But I would have always had an interest. I also, of course, was there for a very sizable part of the Troubles. And that was in, from my experience, the hardest time, the saddest time, the most hopeless time, because I really felt that we would never get through. But I was also lucky enough to be there for the resolution, you know, and so that sense of continuity of having come through it and to see, you know, our beloved country coming out, you know, at least even beginning to come out at the other end was wonderful. The last few years, I have to say again, where we went through that dreadful recession, I found that extremely depressing. And of course, and I'm happy that I'm not there. And God bless everybody who's working their socks off for these times, because this takes the biscuit.
We'd ever thought we'd be in a situation like we are today. And I guess you're right. And we'll definitely talk about that a little bit later. Did you come then, Anne, to love the job?
No. I never really felt I loved the job, but I do think I made very good friends there. And there was a sort of, from my experience, and I imagine most people feel the same in a job, there was a period that I would have regarded as the sort of heyday of the job, if I can put it that way. And there was a time when you came to the realization that, allowing for the odd error, the odd thing that went wrong, we all have those experiences, but that I had got on top of the job. And as time went by, the role of the news presenter changed quite significantly, so that we have much, much more input. And I'm a tiny little bit OCD, to tell you the truth. I like things to be insofar as possible. I like them to be correct. And I do set the bar as high as possible for myself. And so it was important to me to be able to contribute more. It also, of course, made the job much tougher. It made it much more interesting. It made it much more demanding. I couldn't honestly say that I ever jumped out of bed with a skip and went, oh, good, off to work today, Ed.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it is, I think it's a very valid point you made there. People probably don't realise the amount of work and effort and that goes in behind the scenes. And so many things can go wrong, of course.
Yeah, well, I mean, we had a situation at one stage where, because in the newsroom in RTE, you read radio news and do television. And between the headlines, which at that stage, I think, were more or less on the half hour on Lyric and on the hour on Radio 1, RTE 1 radio, I used to go in at about 1:30 to get my makeup done for 9 o'clock. I mean, after that, they could have put a layer of shellac on me, because that was the only part of the day that I had a bigger gap than 25 minutes. And I physically, obviously, had to be back and forward to different studios. So it was a very busy day. And in an odd way, when you came to what was the main part of the job for me, which was the 9 o'clock news, and you started working towards and into that, you already had an exceptionally busy day behind you. And in a way, it was a bad thing, because there was a little feeling of you were almost on the wind down. I'd got all the other stuff done. The positive, I suppose, was that there wasn't a damn thing that had happened that you didn't know about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
In short of a breaking news story. And I mean, you know yourself from broadcasting, the mayhem that could and would break loose around you and in which you were immersed, and you're trying to do headlines and you're trying to find out, you know, and it's 5 to 9. And, you know, one of the things I found, you do sort of lose the run of yourself when you're caught up in any job. I remember occasionally if my telephone rang at 5 to 9, which I obviously wouldn't have answered and clearly should have been in studio to get wired in and all of that, and I'm still trying to do the headlines, and I would look at the phone and think, how could anybody ring me at 5 to 9? Because your whole world revolves around this.
Yeah.
Now 5 to 9 comes and goes in my life, just like everybody else.
You're saying, why isn't anyone ringing me?
Yeah, I mean, you don't even notice. It could be 5 to 10, 5 to 11. But you know, you're so immersed in the whole thing that, you know, it was almost incomprehensible. You
absolutely
forget that the whole world doesn't revolve around you.
Yeah, absolutely. I can identify with that a little bit. That's very good. And that brings us nicely to your first choice of music this evening, Dancing at the Crossroads by the Wild Swans. Now, why have you chosen this song?
Well, of course, without any prejudice at all, I think that it is the best All-Ireland song of the lot. I haven't the slightest doubt that there are 31 counties in Ireland, every one of which would disagree strongly with me. But it is a wonderful, catchy, sing-along song full of joy and brio and liveliness. And it also marks the last time that my beloved Wexford claimed the All-Ireland in 1996. And I had the great joy of being in Croke Park for that occasion. And thanks again, Eileen Dunn, for giving me your ticket. Greater love no woman hath. It was a most noble gesture. And I said to her, no, I couldn't take somebody else's All-Ireland ticket. And she said to me, it's your county. Take it.
A Taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
You're listening to A Taste of Ireland, and my special guest this evening is Anne Doyle. And just before the break there, we were chatting about some highlights in your 30-year career. You were the consummate professional, of course. And then there was that famous kiss on Don't Feed the Gondolas in 2000. What happened?
Well, I've always had a little streak of recklessness in me, to be honest. And it was just a moment of madness. I mean, be fair to poor Brendan O'Connor. I'm sure he has spent a goodly part of his life trying to live that down. It was one of those silly little things. It was a, you know, a fun panel game. And if you got the right answer or the wrong answer or something, you know, the idea was you would exchange a kiss. Except, I suppose, I'm not quite sure anybody actually thought that you would do it.
But Brendan O'Connor would never miss the chance for a snog with a pretty woman, you see,
no,
in those
listen,
days.
Go on, the poor man. I think he was absolutely mortified. And I didn't think anything, no offence to Brendan, of course, it was a splendid moment, but I didn't think anything really of it. But it was only when I started hearing people's reaction. The programme went out one or two days later. It was recorded, I remember, on a Sunday, and it went out on the Monday or Tuesday night. And I suddenly started getting phone calls from people saying, what were you thinking of? And they'll go mad in work. And it only dawned on me then that perhaps it might not be very well received in higher places.
Now, did you get into trouble over that out in RTÉ?
I did and I didn't. I mean, I got the feedback fairly sharpish that it was not at all well regarded. And one who should be nameless, a very senior person, offended me greatly, actually, by saying, you know, that this was absolutely outrageous and that you spend years building up somebody's credibility just for them to throw it away. And whatever credibility I ever had or did not have, I would attribute to myself, not to a senior manager in RTÉ. But our director of news at the time, God bless him, one Ed Mulhall, rode in all of this, of course. You know yourself, you work in this general area and you know how gossip is back before it's even said. And it will lose nothing in the telling, naturally. And Ed, I gather, rose magnificently to the occasion by saying, not at all. Look at all the younger viewers, you know, the people who look at RTÉ2, etc. Sure, she's delivered the whole lot with one kiss or whatever. And nobody ever said anything to me. Well, what's to do? Would you care to think about what unkissing might mean? So I just carried on and pretended I didn't notice.
I think you went from news presenter to national celebrity. I think it was
national
overnight.
National holy show, very possibly. Or maybe to put it another way, Ed, every now and then your true nature makes a little escape. It was only a bit of fun.
Did you always have to be on your guard?
Yeah, I think, yeah, if you were putting a foot wrong now, you'd be in trouble because everybody's standing in very, very high heels. Well, not the men. But it presentation style probably then was even, shall we say, a little more po-faced than perhaps now. But that being said, I still think that it is only correct and respectful that news is delivered with a certain amount of gravitas because you're dealing with very serious matters and you're dealing with people's health and their welfare and their livelihood and the state of the world and the state of people's towns and villages. So it's not a place for, you know, cracking jokes and being flippant. And I would have to say to you, Ed, that I have a rather dangerously flippant side to my nature. So maybe I tried extra hard to keep that in its place. And generally speaking, the material shaped the way you presented it. And also, you are always doing your best to be correct.
I mean, I heard you recently, you used a wonderful word, feckless. I thought it was fabulous. I thought that was it's a word I hadn't heard for a long time. I love it.
Somebody sent me a picture the next day, and I'm not sure if it's a real T-shirt or you know about this sort of thing in a way that I don't, something called meme. There's like a black T-shirt with an outline of my face and it says feckless for life.
Brilliant, brilliant. I think those T-shirts would be great for Christmas.
People are writing to me saying, can I have one? And I said, I don't have one. I don't actually think they exist. I think somebody just made the thing up, you know. But I was amused at the idea. And I was pleased that a throwaway remark, because it's so easy to cause offence to people without meaning to. But, you know, look at the bright side. At least it's only feckless. Maybe we could do one reckless for life as well.
I love it. And I mean, it ties in, I suppose, in a way with, I think it's quite refreshing when you hear people saying, you know, I didn't have a set out plan. And, you know, the way it's great, because today everything is so regimented and, you know, rules and regulations. We've become quite over the top, I think, with it all and overthinking everything.
Yeah, overthinking is a very, very dangerous habit. And I think we all drop in and out of it, hopefully more out than in. But also, the system, the education system is such, and in many ways I applaud it, but because you have, and usefully for people, you know, you have the guidance counselors and you've the people advising you on your career moves, and you have to because of, you know, the requirements of CAO and all of that sort of thing. And look at the chaos we've unfortunately had with the Leaving Cert and so on. So I suppose there's more pressure on people to have a plan as opposed to rambling around and wondering if maybe there was a job in the paper that somebody in the pub said to you, would you have a go at that one? You know, I mean, I believe now that you would actually need a degree in filling in the applications to apply for a job, apparently. I mean, a pal of mine said to me recently, I'd never get a job now in a million years. And I said, and I'd never have got a job. You know, it's very daunting and it is very regulated. And like most reckless, feckless people, I don't overly enjoy the idea of a nanny state.
When you look at the public broadcasting today and you look at TV today, how do you feel about it these days?
Well, I think, to tell you the truth, I, to my astonishment, take most of my news from the telephone, from the apps on the phone. I listen to radio much, much more than I watch television. So I would pick up headlines all over the place. I probably primarily a Radio 1 listener. I actually also listen to Sunshine.
Brilliant.
Because I like that
to relax.
Nice, easy music mix.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get your bit of news here and there. But obviously, in terms of the immediacy of news, that changed significantly. Not so much in the last few years. I mean, that had changed very significantly long before I retired. And in fact, to tell you the truth, it's wonderful when you have a breaking story and you can go to somebody and they can bring you, you know, the latest. But I think it's a little overdone in that we're reinventing the wheel. You know, you actually quite often get the set piece of the three arranged questions at the end of a report. And it's not really a novelty anymore to know that you can actually go over to somebody standing at the city centre. We actually worked that out quite a long time ago. You know, the satellite van didn't arrive a year ago or two. But it's wonderful if you want to deal with a running or a breaking story. And overall, I think across the board, and especially in more recent times when we have all been torn between wanting to know the latest and maybe not wanting to know the latest, I think people in the media in general have excelled themselves in the manner in which they have worked tirelessly, really. And I think that they are very much to be applauded.
And do you think that it's overkill these days, just in terms of, you know, the way we're bombarded with news and with messages all the time? It's just full on. The kids these days, when I was growing up, my mother didn't know where I was for half the time, falling out of trees and everything. Do you think these days things have gone better or worse?
Well, I'm amused that you talk about falling out of trees, because I was a great woman for for the tree climbing myself. How I managed to survive with my limbs intact. I mean, I managed to wait until I was an adult before I started snapping the odd one of those. But I suppose we live in a very different world, and I'm not really very well qualified to speak about this because I didn't have children and I'm not really all that familiar with them. But to me, the idea of children permanently attached to some class of a device, I find extraordinary. But then, you know, in fairness, I grew up in a world where, you know, say you were off school, you got your breakfast and you were all, you know, dispatched out the door and you were told to come home for your dinner at 12:30 or 1 o'clock or whatever. My mother, God rest her, would stand at the back door and holler, you know, and voices carried in the quiet of the country. Lads, it was always lads. I was a girl.
You were a tomboy.
But I mean, all the rest of them were lads. Lads, your dinner is ready. And then, you know, you got your dinner and out the door you went. And I mean, short of actually having done yourself some shocking damage, you were not expected to appear home. I mean, nobody had the time or the energy. But then again, it was, in some respects, it was a more innocent world. And I can see why people worry. Like everything else in life, it's not always easy to chart the middle course.
And that brings us nicely along to your second choice of music this evening. Now, you've picked a lovely song from Willie Nelson, Don't Let the Old Man In.
I read about it before I heard it, actually. I gather that that lovely songwriter, Toby Keith, was playing golf with Clint Eastwood, who mentioned he was starting to work on a new film. I think he was just coming up to his 90th birthday, or certainly late 80s, the next week. And so the conversation turned to age and, you know, how can you do it? And he said, don't let the old man in. And Toby Keith went off, wrote a song. And then, of course, Willie Nelson had to come along and do it too. And actually, you couldn't pass it by. Well, you'll hear the verse, you know. When he rides up on his horse and you feel that cold wind, look out the window and smile. Don't let the old man in.
Don't let the old man in. I won't live up to some more. Can't leave it and smile.
A Taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
You're listening to A Taste of Ireland, and my special guest this evening is national treasure Anne Doyle. And you're very welcome back. You have a great passion for travel, and I know you probably know every road and by road of Ireland at this stage.
One positive of so many of us staying in Ireland this year is that a lot of us have revisited places that perhaps we hadn't visited in a very long time, because we did become great world travellers.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing. Definitely, we have started to discover our country again. And I mean, a lot of people are amazed, even, you know, people that have never been up to Northern Ireland this year, people that have never been to Donegal even, you know, they've all started discovering it. And isn't it amazing that people have been living here for years and they've never travelled around the island at all?
Well, one of the things that has always puzzled me, and perhaps it was because I travelled north a lot from when I was, you know, a teenager, and also in terms of Donegal, my late and only sister went to school in Fallcarragh in Donegal. That was another class of a scholarship. It had actually disappeared before my time. We were opposite ends of the boys. So I was acquainted with north-northwest Donegal. And then this year I had the delight of going with my friend Angus Mulcreane for a few days, and we even got glorious weather. He had a home there for many years. And so we were up around Fallcarragh, Gertha Hawk, then down to the cliffs in Slieve League. The most beautiful county. And then, of course, just across the border, you have the glories of Derry. Derry itself, such a small but interesting and warm city. Derry, in a way, reminds me a bit of how Cork is when you travel south. It's one of those cities that people say hello to you as they pass you by, which doesn't always happen in cities. And I remember there's a wonderful ferry, suspended regrettably at the moment, running over the spring-summer months from Ballycastle over to Campbelltown in Scotland. And I remember getting that several times. It was suspended at one stage years ago, but I'm glad to see it returned. And I remember going in, I was early, and the only reason I went into a pub, and the fellow behind the bar in Ballycastle said to me, hello, Anne. And I didn't, I mean, I was working on television at the time, but I didn't expect in the Glens. And he says to me, great hurling country. You know, and it just, you know, it was just a wonderful moment of unity. You know, but the Glens along there, magnificent. And of course, the causeway and all the spectacular sights. And I think the whole Titanic quarter and development brought a lot of people to Belfast. But I've always been astounded at how many people in the 26 counties who have travelled widely have never gone north. And that would include Donegal. You're quite right.
I mean, it is amazing. I mean, coming from Cork myself, I mean, as I said to you, I was chatting to you there earlier, I had a grandfather who was born in Hollywood, County Down in 1900, and he ended up in Cork. But I mean, it was amazing. So I used to go up when I was a kid.
So you would have always had that kind of family connection.
Yeah, yeah. But very few of my friends are, you know, had ever discovered it. And I mean, when you chatted earlier there about the boutiques and the music scene, and I mean, it was, even going back then, it was just quite exotic, I thought.
It was exotic. I mean, as I say, it was more exotic to me than Dublin, even though I had the great good fortune to fall in love with Dublin as soon as I got here. And I wouldn't consider myself to be the most adaptable of people. So I was terribly fortunate because, you know, many people do find the move to a big city, especially if they come from a very rural place, they find it quite daunting, and probably more so in a way in my time, because all the world, whether we like it or not now, is much more connected, you know. But I was just lucky. But I mean, I remember saying, talking to somebody or other, and Eamon Malley ringing me up because he couldn't stop laughing. I said, but I always loved Dublin, but Belfast was my bit on the side. He said to me, what a terrible way, but what a funny way to do it. But it sort of was, you know, where you love one place dearly,
yeah,
but somewhere else has a little bit of your heart.
Yeah, we have a lot in common. Same with Belfast. I love it as well. It was very interesting to see you, Anne, as well, on a lovely show there earlier in the year about the different places you lived in.
Oh, Lord. And that was a fraction of them.
Yeah. Because I identified.
I must have lived in practically every street in Dublin. There's a touch of the nomad there, obviously.
Brilliant. Yeah, because I mean, when I came up, I remember from Cork first, I moved in, I was in a one room bedsit in Ranelagh in Belgrave Square. And
I lived in Belgrave Square for 20 odd years.
Wow, beautiful place. And there was the phone box downstairs, remember, the black box. And it was another world, but it was absolutely fabulous times.
If you had the black box downstairs, you weren't too badly off. If the other people who lived in the house were anyway half decent. But the killer was when you didn't have the black box and you're standing outside in the rain. And this is usually to do with some, you know, aspirational affair of the heart, you know.
Yes.
Somebody has said they'll ring you at 8:30 or you're ringing them at 8:30 and you've got all, or you see the fella or the girl in the box, they first turn their back on you. That's always a bad sign. Then you see them unloading their pockets, which were full of coins, and you realise they were
talking.
Going to be there for 2.5 hours, you know, and you waited and you waited and you waited. Girl, don't come. When I did that, Brendan Courtney did the programme, The Keys to My Life, I mean, I had pleasure in my bedsitter one, the one with the coin box in the hall, the lady who owns that house, who's a good bit older than I am, but doesn't look a day of it. I had the pleasure of meeting her afterwards, and I know her to this day. I mean, she walked in and it was, you know, it was just lovely to see her. When I went up to the little house in Highfield Grove, my three next door neighbours came out to say hello, and I know them all and I'm still in contact. And I left there in, I think it was 1986. So, you know,
wonderful.
Yeah. You know, you form alliances with people. And that, of course, is the very sad thing for, especially say people who have, but it's not just people who've reared children. It's any of us, those who have or haven't children, maybe those who haven't. We build our own community. And then just like that, it's gone.
I went to Moly recently, you know, the new Museum of Literature of Ireland that they put just beside Staunton's Hotel there. And I did a mad thing. I stayed in Staunton's for a night. It was a little birthday and it was just such fun.
I believe it's absolutely beautiful.
It was fabulous. And it was really enjoyable. And Moly, of course, right next door.
I always fancied staying in Staunton's. You lucky devil.
Yeah,
you were right to stay.
They have great deals at the moment. But yeah, great. And the garden is beautiful there as well. And you have little patios and stuff. So I highly recommend it. It was wonderful.
And actually, actually, it is a time where you can stay. You can actually stay anywhere at the moment. Places that would have been,
absolutely
beyond one's reach. It's doable.
I did a very posh little overnight in the Wilder up in leafy Adelaide Road as well, and that was fabulous too.
Oh, yes, I know. Just before they opened, they were just doing a kind of practice run, you know, setting tables outside, etc. And I went in to inquire, but regrettably, it is open only to residents. But they showed me round and it was fabulous.
Yeah, beautiful.
And I said, I'd be ever so good if you let me in.
Yeah, a former home for retired governesses.
It's a sister of a hotel, which is similar, I gather, in Cork.
That's right, the Montanotti. Yeah.
Oh, the Montanotti.
A former retirement home for governesses, Anne. You'd love it.
Oh, sure, I was born for it, obviously. I'll wrap your knuckles now.
And during the lockdown, did you learn anything, any new skills, or did you become a master baker?
I'm a great believer in if you want sourdough, you can buy it, you know. No, I didn't. And I'm not going to pretend that the lockdown agreed with me at all. In fact, what I found very worrying primarily about it, apart from the fact that I was extremely anxious about the impact on our beloved country, on our health and welfare, obviously, on our mental health, on our economy, in any order you care to put them, and indeed on the effect on the world, which is almost incomprehensible. But I found that my focus went out the window. I didn't even... I'm a reader. I'm a big reader, and I can forget about things when I read. And I found it took me ages even to read a book.
Yeah.
I found it quite disconcerting. And I've heard people talk about it and say COVID fog and brain fog and all the rest of it. So it was a bit of a comfort to realise that this was a very common condition. But I applaud the people who, you know, took up sewing and tatting and crewel work and embroidery and so on. But no, regrettably, I'm not one of them. But I did apply myself to put on the COVID stone, as one does.
I have the COVID baby here as well.
I was able to find the means, Ed, without actually having to slave over the stove.
Oh, brilliant. And now it's been great to chat to you this evening. Before we finish up, just in terms of guilty pleasure, now food-wise I'm talking about here, right? Mm. What would your guilty pleasure be?
I'm okay in that department. I'm not one of those people who munches through television programmes or music or whatever. Might knock back the odd little vodka now, or maybe a little glass of vino. I think they'd be more in the guilty pleasure. But my downfall is I have always been blessed, actually, with a very big appetite. So I eat too much. My eating habits are good, but I eat too much. I don't have a sweet tooth or any of that sort of thing. But sure, if you're having the odd jar, you don't need that.
Little olive. Very fabulous.
Yeah, a little olive is a grand. A little bit of cheese. Oh, a little bit of blue cheese now. Oh, that'd be a temptation.
Mm, very posh. Mm. What would you say to people that are sort of suffering a bit now at the moment?
Well, to tell you the truth, Ed, I often think in terms of getting through, I think you mentioned something really quite important. We should guard against overthinking and double thinking, because that way lies madness. And as a people, you know, we have survived a lot. I was reading only very recently about the Great Famine of 1367, where it is generally acknowledged that we ate each other. Well, it hasn't come to that. Now, you and I want to go easy on the COVID thing. We don't want to be too plump and attractive. But, you know, we have survived a lot. And please God, the whole world will survive this. So what do? You get up in the morning, as long as you're able to, you put one foot in front of another and look out the window and grin.
Wonderful, Anne. That brings us really nicely into the song that you've chosen to finish up this evening, Try a Little Tenderness with Otis Redding.
I'm a huge fan of the late and much regretted Otis. I was put to the pin of my collar to think which one to choose, but... You know, we're all getting a little weary, and it's no harm to try a little tenderness.
Anne Doyle, it has been a wonderful pleasure to have you on the show this evening, and thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure is all mine, Ed.
Oh, she may be weary. Young girls, they do get weird.